This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll hear about the work being done by citizen scientists in Southwest Michigan. But first, author Tracy McMillan's book, The American Way of Eating, is one of the selections this year for the Kalamazoo Public Library's Reading Together program. She will speak at Kalamazoo Central High School tonight. WMUK correspondent Brian Peterson spoke with Tracy McMillan via Skype.
There have been a number of books coming out recently. Food is a really important topic recently. You've taken a very different approach, sort of going undercover. Tell us a little bit about how you came to this project.
You know, in the mid-aughts, I was really interested in seeing a lot of the conversations that were coming up around food, particularly the work of Michael Pollan, which also drew on Eric Schlosser, both of whom do really great work. But my background is as a poverty reporter, and I'm also from a working class background. And so I really felt like so much of the discussion around food was geared towards people with a lot of extra money and a lot of extra time. And I felt like that was sort of missing the point, right? Which is that everybody kind of deserves, and most people want healthy food. I mean, I talk about this in The American Way of Eating, but there just aren't that many people walking around saying, oh, I don't care if I have diabetes, that would be fine with me, right? And I really wanted to do a project that could sort of get at why food was important for most people. And there was a little bit of class angst. So much of the food discussion is told in this sort of very rarefied upper class way. And I really wanted to sort of throw a wrench in that machine, so to speak. And so I figured the best way to go and do that would be to go and work undercover in three jobs in the food system and then live and eat off my wages while I had each job, and use that to both look at how the food system worked, but also sort of how limited wages and time changed the way that I ate or the way I thought about food, and really sort of, you know, look at it from the ground up.
So I want to talk about all that, but first, the title of your book, The American Way of Eating, really begs the question, what is the American way of eating? How would you characterize it?
I'd say the American way of eating is really driven by time and convenience in a lot of ways. You know, folks, when they have jobs, are working quite a lot. And so it becomes sort of very important to be able to eat quickly. You know, we talk a lot about how, you know, women went into the workforce. And the sort of the flip side of that is, you know, somebody's still got to do the cooking. And, you know, if you're working 40 hours a week and you're taking the kids to soccer practice and doing all of that, right, cooking is not easy to do necessarily. And I sort of see that across most parts of the economy. You know, and for the American way of eating, I was living with farm workers in California, and, you know, those folks have very limited incomes, but when they can afford it, you know, they're very happy to go and get a pizza to pick up just because, you know, they're working so hard during the day.
Now, just following on that, you talk about your experience working in the fields in California. Most Americans have no idea where their food comes from. What did you learn as that process of working in the fields?
One of the biggest things I learned working in the fields was that farm labor is really highly skilled. It's not skilled in the same way, you know, that the work that I do is skilled, but it still requires training and time and patience and learning. I mean, when I was learning to pick grapes, I write about this in the American Way of Eating. I was getting very frustrated because it was going so slowly. And then one of my coworkers turned to me and said, you know, don't worry about it. You know, it takes 6 weeks before you can even start to do this well.
You also talk about your experience in terms of how much work it is. You were exhausted. You got injured. Talk about the actual physical labor.
Yeah, so farm labor is a very hard job. It's physically very demanding. I went through three jobs. I worked in peaches, grapes, and garlic. And the hardest was definitely the peaches, because I was doing that in the Central Valley in the middle of summer. So during a heat wave, although actually in the Central Valley, it's probably not even a heat wave, but there, I worked for about 5-6 days straight in 105 degree heat. And what happened is that towards the end of that, my body just wasn't able to deal with the heat. And so I got heat sick after work, and sort of spent an afternoon projectile vomiting. People die in the fields pretty much every year from the heat out there, because folks are working, they're not drinking enough water, they're required to work at sort of very fast paces in order to make up the quota that they need for the day. And so that's all incredibly, incredibly demanding work. So, I mean, I was able, because I am a writer and don't have to survive off of those wages all the time, I was able to leave the Central Valley. And that's when I went and did garlic picking, which is not the same degree of physical strain that, you know, sort of working 105 degree heat is. But picking garlic is incredibly demanding on your body, particularly your knees, because you're sitting down in the dirt and getting back up again all the time. And then also your arms. So I developed, after about a month or so, I developed tendonitis so severe in my arm that I couldn't use it anymore. And I had to stop working for a week.
And beyond just the physical labor, you also write very interestingly about how you survived during that time. Talk about how much you made, how much you spent on food, and how difficult it was just to get by.
Right. So when I was working in the fields, I was earning on average about $3 an hour, $3.50 an hour. So I was being paid by piece, which in California, piece rate still has to reach minimum wage. And so I was being paid illegally low wages. You know, that's not something that lined up with labor law, but because most everyone I worked with was undocumented, the people that were running the company figured they could just not pay legal wages and no one would complain. And it's true, nobody did. And so when I was earning that kind of money, I was spending around a quarter of my income on food, right, which is a lot higher than the national average. Most Americans spend more like, I think it's it's more like 13% of their income on food. And this is something that actually stretches out into the general population. Generally speaking, the poorer people are, the higher share of their income they're spending on food. And so, you know, I always feel like that's an important thing to keep in mind when we're talking about the idea that good food just has to cost more and people should just pay more if they want to have healthy food. You know, that's sort of building in the idea that, well, just poor people don't need to have healthy food. And we end up paying for that later in public health costs.
And you talk about that in the book, that there's all this fresh produce in this country, and yet it's not actually getting to people all the time. Why is that?
This was really interesting. For a good chunk of the book, right, I reported both in the Kalamazoo area and in Detroit. And Detroit was really fascinating because it brought into clear focus the problem of food access in this country. So Detroit has this reputation as being what's been called a food desert, a neighborhood or community that doesn't have sufficient grocery stores. But it also has one of just 15 produce terminal markets that are still in existence around the country, as well as Easter Market, a big wholesale market for farmers. And all the food from Michigan pretty much comes into Detroit. So there is food in Detroit. It's just that there's no system for getting it into the neighborhoods into some of the neighborhoods. And so that for me was really fascinating to sort of realize this actually isn't a problem if we don't have food. It's a problem that we don't have a system to get it into communities. And then once you start peeling back the sort of layers and trying to figure out why it works that way, you know, a big issue is that over the last generation, food retailers like Walmart have really consolidated and started to take up bigger and bigger pieces of the food retail industry. So now about a quarter of all of our food in the U.S. moves through Walmart. And in communities where it is selling, it's often an even larger share of food sales. I mean, there are towns in the U.S. where Walmart is 50, 60, 70% of the local food market. And so when you start looking at that, you sort of realize, okay, so chains are deciding or not deciding to be in places. And then that also means that they are sort of privatizing and bringing inward like all of the distribution mechanics and all of the logistics. So where you used to have a lot of wholesale markets in different towns that could sort of be like, here's where grocery stores can come and get food. Now, the big grocery stores are all bringing that stuff in-house. And what that means is sort of, if you want to start a little grocery store, you know, say outside of Kalamazoo or something, now you've got to figure out where on earth you can go to get produce, because those wholesale markets have shut down because the big markets have been taking up all the space.
So you spent part of your time in Michigan in the Kalamazoo area and actually working at a Walmart. Talk about your experience.
Yeah, so it was really interesting. I worked at a Walmart out in that area in November on the night shift in the baking aisle. So that was not my favorite job, for sure. And what was really interesting to me was it's sort of made very concrete, like just how much work goes into even running something like a Walmart. Like I guess I just sort of blindly been thinking in my head, like, oh yeah, there's stuff in the store and it's there. Well, people put all that stuff up, right? Like all those shelves, somebody took like the box of flour and opened it and put the bags of flour on the shelf. And that was me for, you know, a month or so one winter. And so I was really impressed with just sort of how much work goes into that. And then also for me, it was really interesting to sort of look at how my coworkers were able to eat when they were working those kinds of jobs, right? Because most folks, you know, weren't making a lot of money. Folks that had been there for a long time were making $11 and $12 an hour, right? Which is starting to get closer to a good job. But especially when you're doing sort of night shift stuff and you're really tired all the time, you know, your diets just sort of devolve into a lot of snacks and chips because it's just, you know, how you're thinking about your day is really different.
And you also, over time at Walmart, worked into the produce section. I'm just wondering how you sort of thought about produce before you went in and after your experience.
Yeah, well, before I worked at Walmart, I really had this idea that, you know, there was a lot of care and attention probably being paid to produce sections. And at least at the Walmart that I worked at for produce, that was not the case. I write about this in The American Way of Eating. The produce manager in my section was 20 years old. He came from the electronics department. He had really no understanding or knowledge about produce or food. And so, I mean, I had a day where I threw away 200 pounds of asparagus because it had been left in the cooler for over a month and was molding over and hadn't been rotated out. And so it really underscored for me sort of what an important job a produce manager has. Particularly when you're looking at markets where there's only one or two supermarkets. I mean, that 20-year-old kid that I was working under was responsible for half of the fresh food in a town, right? And nobody was treating him like he was important or needed to have proper training, or treating him with sort of the respect that I would think, you know, if we thought about produce management in that way, right? Nobody was treating him with the respect that, you know, that would accord.
And you also, in this project, went to New York City and worked in an Applebee's. And you write about it very interestingly in your book. What were some of your experiences working in that restaurant?
Yeah, so I really loved working in the kitchen. I find restaurant work to be actually like really fun and engaging. So I enjoyed that quite a lot. Probably the most interesting thing for me was realizing that, you know, very small decisions can have a really big impact on the quality of food. And what I mean by that is at the Applebee's, they would make the mashed potatoes and broccoli in advance and then heat it up when it was going out to diners. And so the way that worked is the potatoes are made from real potatoes that were just, they were rinsed, they weren't scrubbed, they're steamed, they're mashed by hand, right? So those are definitely real potatoes. And then they were mixed with something called garlic milk, which was this white frozen liquid that came in a bag and then gets defrosted and it tastes very good. I have no idea what's in it. You know, the potatoes taste fine with it. And then you, what happens is you bag up 10 ounces of potatoes and then you put them in the plastic bag. And then when it comes time for the cooks to serve it, they nuke the bag. And so what was interesting is that, so these sides are prepared in advance. Easy way to keep them portioned properly is to have them in a plastic bag. That seems reasonable. Then you nuke them really quickly before they're going out. That seems kind of reasonable. But what would happen in practice is that those bags get nuked over and over again. They get stuck under the heat lamp. And so when we had to send them out to tables, the plastic would disintegrate onto the food. Right. So it'd sort of flake out and sort of fall apart. And for me, it was sort of this thing where I was like, I feel like that probably sounded like a good idea at the time, but that's pretty disgusting, right? To have plastic in your food.
And you write that one of the cooks you were talking to basically said, we don't actually cook.
Yeah. I mean, the folks that are working in the kitchen at Applebee's understand very well, you know, they're not really cooking. It's almost all reheating of things that have already been cooked somewhere else. Or putting together pre-configured ingredients, right? So stuff like the garlic milk and the mashed potatoes, right? The soups all come in frozen in bags. All of the sauces come in pre-made. There's one small set of shelves in the walk-in for fresh produce. And the only fresh produce that they have are lettuce, tomato, and onions, because those have to be sliced and put on burgers, and then the whole potatoes. Everything else comes in at least pre-cut, if not pre-made.
Now, earlier we talked about this, touched on this notion that it's perceived that people who eat healthy are sort of wealthy or well off. And there's kind of been almost a backlash where people who do eat healthy are kind of perceived as sort of food snobs or something. That seems to be a bit of a paradox, given that we want people to eat healthy.
I think the thing is that so much of the discussion around healthy food can be kind of class blind and sort of clueless in a way. And that just makes it feel like if you really care about eating healthy, you must sound like Alice Waters. And that's actually not true, right? There's like a very strong and long tradition in a lot of different communities of eating healthy. I mean, there's a wonderful tradition around fresh vegetables, eating healthy in the Black community, Black health movement stuff. I mean, that stuff is really important. And it gets sort of sidelined and ignored as if that doesn't actually count. I do a lot of reporting around the country now, and I meet all kinds of people from all walks of life that, you know, are really making a go of it in terms of trying to eat well and eat healthy. You know, what most people tend to run up against, though, is that so much of what's in our food supply is not healthy. And so, you know, right now in the U.S., it is much easier to eat a crappy diet than it is to eat a healthy one. I mean, that's just the truth. I'm not saying it's not possible, but it's just it's more affordable. It's quicker to eat a crappy diet than to eat a healthy one. And so that's really, I think, where you start running into questions of like, well, who is this actually for? Because folks that are dealing with limited income or limited time, you know, they usually don't have the same choices where they can just sort of buy better food for more money.
And then just to conclude, you write really eloquently in the book about the relationships you made during this whole process and the wonderful people you met. Many of them didn't know at the beginning that you were undercover as a writer. I'm just wondering if you could share some thoughts on how people reacted when you actually told them about your whole project.
Sure. So actually, generally speaking, people are pretty nonplussed. I really only had like a sort of big coming out moment with the folks in the fields in California. So there were two families I was very close to, the family I sort of lived with and then the family I worked with. And so when I told the family that I was living with, I was sort of like, well, you know, I'm a writer and I'm probably going to be writing about this. And they were sort of like, oh, okay. Did you want some more soup? You know, they were like, okay. And I think some of that is probably a degree of media literacy, right? Like not necessarily understanding that would mean other people would pay attention, but also probably some degree of really understanding that, you know, as much as, you know, I think there's a lot of value in doing that book project, right? Like my doing it doesn't really change the fact of their life very much, you know? And then the second family was actually much more excited. They were more involved in community organizing. They're in Greenfield in California. And so their response was like, oh, this is great. This is even better than we thought. We thought you were a government inspector. And so this is really exciting. Like you can tell people sort of what life is like in the fields. I mean, there is a real strong sense among farm workers and migrant workers that nobody pays any attention or understands what they're doing or appreciates it. And there's a real strong sense of, you know, wanting that story to be heard.
Author Tracy McMillan spoke via Skype with WMUK correspondent Brian Peterson. McMillan's book, The American Way of Eating, is one of the selections this year for the Kalamazoo Public Library's Reading Together program. Tracy McMillan will speak tonight at Kalamazoo Central High School. Details can be found at WMUK.org.